This episode of Designed by Architectural Record is sponsored by Vitro Architectural Glass. Glass has a new day job. You can now generate clean, CO2-free energy with building-integrated photovoltaic glass. SolarVolt BIPV modules by Vitro Architectural Glass can now replace traditional building envelope materials, exterior elements, and more, resulting in the next generation energy-efficient design. Supercharge your next project at vitrosolarvolt.com. That's Vitro, solar, volt, as in voltage, .com.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Designed, a podcast by Architectural Record. We appreciate you listening, and once finished, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast, rate us, and leave a comment. If you'd like to learn more about Designed and see all the other great content that Architectural Record has to offer, please visit architecturalrecord.com for more information. Enjoy the show and have a wonderful day.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Designed by Architectural Record. I'm your host, Aaron Prenz. As always, I just want to start out by saying thank you to everyone for listening to the podcast, of course, sharing it with your friends. And if you could just drop us a review on the iTunes review section, that's really the easiest way for us to get the podcast out to more people. So we'd really appreciate it. Of course, be sure to check out architecturalrecord.com and, of course, follow the podcast on Instagram at designed.podcast for everything we have coming up so you don't miss anything. This week's episode, we have something a little bit different. We have Charles Brooks, Ruben Mohuddin, and Barry Long joining us to talk about the rebuilding of Paradise, California. Now, if you're unfamiliar with Paradise, it's a small little town of about 26,000 people up in Northern California, about an hour and a half north of Sacramento, the state's capital. On November 8th, 2018, it was actually hit by one of the strongest wildfires that the country that I've ever seen. It took 28 days for the fire to be contained, with over 153,000 acres burned. Over 85 people had lost their lives, 17 injured, and over 18,000 buildings were burned, pretty much erasing the town overnight. So with the third anniversary of the fire coming up, we just check in, see how the rebuilding efforts are going, how this could have been prevented, their take both before and after the fire. And there's a lot to take away from this episode, so I think you all are really going to enjoy it. And if you want to get involved, if you want to help, the website is rebuildparadise.org. That's the organization that Charles runs, and they'll be able to provide some sort of guidance on what they need. So without further ado, sit back, relax, enjoy. Here we go with Rebuilding Paradise.
Now, I think it's important to understand that Northern California, especially once you go north of Sacramento, it's not necessarily what someone would expect California to be. It's a series of small towns, large emphasis on agriculture as a main source of industry. And, you know, they don't have the funding that, say, Los Angeles or San Francisco gets necessarily. And so, Ruben, I want to start with you as a professor at California State University, Chico, and you also have an architecture firm there. Having 26,000 people displaced, and, you know, there's reports from the Los Angeles Times, I believe that it's, you know, only 150 homes out of 14,000 were able to be saved. So as the resulting area, I mean, you have Redding, Red Bluff, Chico, combined those towns maybe have, what, 250,000 people in them total.
Sure.
So when you have 26,000 that are just immediately displaced, this isn't Los Angeles where that would be like a drop in the bucket, essentially. What does that do to the surrounding areas?
Well, it completely changes the dynamics, from social dynamics to the economic driven businesses and such. So I think, you know, if I were to kind of put myself into that day from what I recall, I remember, you know, I had a class at 8 a.m. in the morning and I was driving to campus and I just saw this dark cloud coming from the south of town. And it's kind of like, what is that? Is there a thunderstorm going on? And so I took a picture as I'm walking into my building. And with this black cloud looming overhead the building. As soon as I walked in, of course, you know, I find out what's really going on. And then, you know, we were in class, we had a discussion, and a lot of the students are from here, from the surrounding areas. And everybody was kind of worried. They had people, family, friends living in that part of town. I knew a lot of people there. And the next thing, you know, we're just sort of hearing sort of stories. We're seeing live pictures on Facebook of people trying to get out of there. And meanwhile, I get a call from my wife saying, hey, we have some friends coming over. Here's what's going on. And so I really got to see, I wasn't there, of course, but I got to see what some of these folks had to go through. And they captured it on video. Fire all around, driving through one road, not sure if they're going to be getting out of there or not. And so
which, all for of the sudden, people, for the people that haven't seen the footage, it is terrifying to watch. It looks like
it's terrifying.
Dante's Peak or one of those movies from the 90s, like a disaster film, but that's real life that people experienced.
It's very apocalyptical, if you will, and the imagery and the scenery. And so the next few days really changed the, first of all, it was the environmental effect, right? So you have the smoke, the dust, the ashes, all of that. And so we all had to start thinking about how we do we protect ourselves? Do we have to evacuate? So there was a lot of hustle and bustle within Chico to figure out what we're going to do. Meanwhile, the disaster relief shelter center got established. They took the Sears in the Chico Mall and converted it into the center, and people started pouring in. And so all of a sudden you saw parking lots getting filled up. You saw interstitial spaces between residential places where there were just lawns or fields getting filled up with people just pulling up with their cars who were able to get out of there and figuring out what to do next. So all of a sudden it felt like, you know, as a Chico resident, that there was this huge influx of different kinds of people who had come here with nothing. They just came, got out of the fire. And, you know, I think, you know, when you start seeing that, you know, you start seeing there's a cause effect, a domino effect in terms of everything from the gas stations, the grocery stores to initially it was, of course, everyone's helping everybody. And then all of a sudden people are starting thinking about what we're going to happen in our kid. Do we have to leave? Do we have enough food? What's going to happen in the store? So it was kind of like one of those apocalyptical movies.
Kind of like,
and it's the best way I can explain it.
What I can kind of relate to that in a sense with the snowstorm we had in Texas. You know what I mean? At the beginning, it was like, oh, it's going to be, you know, it's just a fire. Oh, it's just a storm. And before you know it, you're like, oh, there's no groceries left anywhere in this city. So it's kind of crazy. And from an urban planning perspective, I mean, Barry, maybe you can elaborate on this a little bit more. When you have an entire town that's displaced, it seems like, you know, I'm here in Austin where high rises pop up like every single day. There's a building that can house 26,000 people if it needed to. Paradise isn't the case. So how does that, as an urban planning aspect, how does that all play out?
Well, it was, and we do disaster recovery around the country. This wasn't the first community that we worked in support of and helping them figure out how to rebuild. However, the context was very unique. And I had an opportunity, I think, to visit for the first time on December 12th, so a little more than a month after the fire. You couldn't stay anyplace close to Chico. Every hotel was booked. Folks were camped out. They were staying with friends. There were mobile homes, RVs everywhere. And many people, as we know, because FEMA tracked them, had actually left. They were scattered across 46 states. So just trying to figure out where to start. And we actually started by talking about, I think the mayor asked, where do we start? How do you rebuild? And we said, you need to ask the residents. And we really felt deeply about that the residents had to determine, the residents of Paradise, how to rebuild, when to rebuild. And that's where the process started. And that kicked off in January. But it didn't have the term is overused when you say there isn't a playbook, but I mean, literally, there wasn't really an approach for even community engagement. How do you engage residents who are scattered across the country? So, you know, now we've lived through a year of virtual engagement, but a lot of what our practice has done over the last year and a half was born in Paradise because we were confronted with needing to engage many folks virtually as well as in person. It's a unique context.
Yeah, and you're in Pittsburgh, so I mean, Pittsburgh right. To Paradise, that's like
that's right.
Not exactly what you would expect.
It's a short flight away, which was made, as Charles knows, dozens of times, it seems. But, well, I think in a way that was fortunate. It gave us a little bit of a separation and perspective. It was so, I think, difficult for the residents in the Tri-County area, and especially the Paradise residents. And I know Charles' story. The day of the fire, because we've sat down and talked about it. And I mean, having lived that and being so close to it, it's really difficult, I think, to look out to the future. First, we asked residents, you know, what's your campfire story? And, you know, what happened the day of the fire? And they really need to be able to talk about that before you can even begin talking about rebuilding the community. We were there to listen, and there was a lot of listening and really what we heard from residents is we want to build back a better version of what we have, but we don't want to completely change our community or redesign it, which we could have. But that wasn't what the residents wanted, and we respected that. And that's what the planning that was done over the first half of, it was really done in the first 3 months of 2019, or over a three-month period after the fire. That's what came out of that, a plan, a blueprint for rebuilding, which is still ongoing and will be for many years.
And Charles, maybe this is a good time to bring you in here. I mean, I don't want to have you, you know, go over your story in like a, you know, a big public place if you want to, but in terms of, you know, it's a resident of a very small town. You have people not from the area coming in to help out. What were you looking for? What was the town looking for? What was the environment like at the time, and how has that all unfolded, and what does it look like now?
I think one of the unique things that happened, and with a disaster of this magnitude and scale, is that many of us realized that if the community is to recover, we can't do it alone. There's not enough. We had a jurisdiction that in a good year built 15 to 20 homes, just to kind of give you some perspective of the capacity of the community. And there were short, many people.
14,000 all at once, right? Like,
yeah. And so you have this situation where you're looking at, and as a resident, we weren't allowed, many of us weren't allowed back into the areas where our homes once were for over a month. And so you have a month of getting information from Facebook, from people, you're seeing pictures, you're hearing news stories, but you can't see your own property. One of the things that happens is you go, okay, we can't even see our home. What are we going to do here, and how can we do this? And a few of us in the community started talking, and we realized within a day or two that there's no way we're going to go about this alone. And as the amazing amount of humanity that showed up from around the world to support our community with food, with money, with clothing, with offers of help, come live in our house, you know, we have an extra bedroom, your family is welcome. All this stuff started pouring in. And that was kind of the starting point for where people had to finally say, you know what? I can't do this myself. We're a very, very pull yourself up, figure out how to do it type of community, like most rural communities tend to be. I'll get it done myself type of mentality. You're now looking at this going, we need a lot of help. And this is where we need a lot of professional help. Our jurisdiction is going to need to be augmented by a lot of professionals to be able to navigate just the federal disaster relief that we're going to need access to, let alone planning and augmenting our planning and permitting departments. As the community is looking to the jurisdiction to say, okay, how do we do this? There's no playbook to how to recover when 91% of your residential structures are lost. There's nothing there. And when serious amounts of infrastructure have been destroyed, and that's where a combination of philanthropy and connections brought Barry Long and UDA to the community. And from the first time I heard Barry present, it didn't feel like an outsider that was just coming in to tell us what we were going to do and how we were going to do it. And that is an approach that I'm hoping other communities learn from us, and they access resources that will come in a similar way. What can we do? How can we help? Here's our experience, and here's where we're professionals. And my entire interaction with the entire UDA organization was absolutely fantastic. And the way that they went alongside our community was really incredible.
Well, to think about just in general, and we're going to get to step back from paradise for a second, the architecture community, in my opinion, there's a lot of people that know everything. There's a lot of people that know this is the way to do it. And architecture with a capital A, as I'm sure Ruben and Barry know, is that, you know, a really fancy building is going to solve every single problem that you have inside your community. But what I find so interesting about this story, and what I really love about it and why I wanted to present it, is that you're not replacing paradise with some Disney version of paradise or whatever it may be. You're replacing paradise with what paradise was. And so can we just talk about how you all came together? What does this future of paradise look like, and how is it going about being implemented?
Well, we all have a perspective on that, I'm sure, but I would say that, I mean, we all, I think, believe in architecture with a little A. And you really have to appreciate that Paradise contained a majority, maybe, of the region's naturally occurring affordable housing. And when you're faced with building back to a standard that the community wasn't originally built to be more fire resistant, that's a hurdle that's going to immediately add cost. And Charles highlighted the infrastructure is not there to build back the number of homes right away that we needed to. It was limited. The way most homes get built in California right now is by production builders. So they have economies in doing production building. That's not the way Paradise could be built back. And I think Charles recognized that early on and actually formed a foundation to begin to address that, which he can speak to. But I mean, we took time while we were there to meet with the manufactured home dealers, because we realized in speaking with the residents that for probably about a third of them, that was going to be the route they were going to have to take because that's what they could afford. The manufactured home dealers do provide homes that meet the wild and urban interface standard code standards. And in our practice, I think that was unique because you're right. Architects can practice with a capital A and try to re-envision everything. But if you listen to the residents, and we'd worked regionally before, we weren't new to the region, but we were new to disaster recovery in that region. If you understand that there has to be a balance between affordability and maybe perfection, and you have to check your vision at the door and really listen to what the residents are saying. Although there are places we can help them with safety, you know, and having the community be designed more safely and improving some infrastructure and deficiencies from before. But Paradise is not a place that wants to be perfect. If it tried to be perfect, it wouldn't be rebuilt. That was evident early on.
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, I moved to Chico about 10 years ago. And prior to this, I was practicing in New York. In the city, and before that I was in LA. So most of my background was working in larger cities, and I have worked for some well-known architects when I started out right out of school. And so I had a very different perspective of what architecture really is and how we go about doing it and what is the outcome and such. Long story short, years later I decided to go into academics. This was about 10 years ago. I decided to kind of leave the big city and pursue teaching in design and architecture in these. So I moved to Chico. Chico was a big culture shock for my family and I. And we're like, whoa, this is different.
My brother moved back there after San Francisco of 10 years. And he's like, people wear pajamas as pants here. And so I'm just like, oh.
Yes. And so, you know, I remember the first few weeks, I felt like I was just, you know, overdressed in many ways. And so I started, you know, changing the way I dress and such. But I think for me, it gave me a new perspective of a different part of this country, especially, you know, moving here as a kid. I was 17 when I moved here, having experienced bigger cities, never really experienced the middle of the country, or if you will, the other parts beyond San Francisco, LA, Chicago, New York. And I started, you know, as an academic, I started getting involved in some grants and small scale community projects, working with local organizations. And some private projects. And I started getting to know people within the community, their culture, their traditions and such. And so all of a sudden I had a very different perspective and approach to what I had originally been accustomed to, in terms of how we approach clients in a city, for example. So for me, it was very, you know, going when Barry came here and they were doing the development of the early phase development. We heard about it, as a student. I mentioned to my students, they're like, we gotta be a part of this. We want to see what this is. We want to attend the meetings. I basically said, you guys got to go see this guy present and how he comes up with ideas and such. And during that process, I was volunteering at the disaster relief, center and, you know, just there helping out. And most of it in the beginning was really listening to stories. I've met people from Concow, small places, not just outside of Paradise too, who've lost homes. And these were people from generational, like there was grandparents and kids and their kids. And it was 3-4 generations of families. All of a sudden their entire community is gone. And so that really started giving you a very different perspective in terms of how one should approach design and architecture in this part. And on a personal level, I have a few private projects that I'm doing for a few different clients, all rebuilding. And I think, you know, it's not like, oh yes, I just bought a piece of property. I want to build this beautiful home. Let's do this. this is a recovery process on their part. It's an emotional process. And so in terms of a practitioner, even the way you speak and discuss and make decisions during the process is different than a standard project. So for me, you know, I got involved academically by creating a little assignment and saying, hey, what if we start looking into design and disaster relief, shelters, those kinds of things. We started that semester a studio project where we were doing small scale architecture, shelters and such. And that led to finding out that Montana State and Cal Poly San Luis Obispo were working on a similar assignment. They were going to come to Chico to do a little presentation. So I called both the professors there and I said, hey, so where are you guys coming to? They were here with their students and they were stuck in the construction management department. And in the small classroom, there's lots of people, lots of posters. So my students and I, our entire department went over there to say hi and met some of the professors and the students. And we're like, well, you guys need a better space and this needs to be more public and get the community involved. And that's how I met Charles. And during that final presentation, which ended up happening in our department, there's a lot of people coming over and seeing the work. And I think, Barry, you had just presented your plan a few days mm-hmm. prior to that at the church. And so we were there watching your presentation. And that during that time, I met with Charles and I kind of said, hey, Charles, what do you think? Do you need any help in any way? You know, we're here. Me as a practitioner and also as an academic capacity, you know, and so this idea of, you know, a floor plan library started floating around and to incentivize.
Well, I'm curious, you know, are people, and Charles, you might be able to speak better to this, but are people looking to rebuild the same home they had? Or are they looking to kind of revamp and, you know, let the past be the past and go forward from there?
I think that is going to be such an individual choice. It would be hard to paint with a brush because people's recoveries a lot are dependent on their insurance mm-hmm. proceeds, how much they have to work with. Many people would love to build back what they had square footage wise. If people were well insured, they said, hey, now's a chance to kind of build something that we might like to make a few modifications to or something completely different. Other people who are underinsured or non-insured, they just want a home. They want to be back home on their property, and they've had to check a lot of wants and basically go with what are they able to do. And that's many people, cost of construction, cost of redevelopment, all those things play into, am I able to rebuild what I want, or is it going to be what is it that I can afford?
And I think also the pandemic has to have added some sort of level of stress to the situation. I mean, you look at lumber prices, they're up 300% from where they were, you know, a year ago. How has that all impacted this rebuilding process?
Definitely the lumber prices have impacted. So people are thinking about their schedules, when to start, if they're not started yet. The other thing that I've noticed is one of the projects we did, one of the smaller homes, option one, I think, called the Honey Run or something. It was basically designed as a stick frame. It was an 800 square foot structure, simple two bedroom, one bath. Now Habitat for Humanity is doing some work up there also. And they are doing, they converted it, engineered it into an ICF system. And so there is some of that going on. So some alternative methods of construction happening there that is atypical of the region. And then we're also seeing, I've met a few clients who are doing hay bale construction, and so there's a few other alternative things happening, but most of the structures that are going up there are all standard stick frame construction with upgraded 2021 codes requirements.
For folks that don't know, the WUI code is required in Paradise Wildland Urban Interface Code. Some states, California, requires it for areas that are at risk of wildfire. I'm generalizing, but that's not exactly what the code says, but in general. I will say, though, for Paradise, if it had happened a year later, it would have been much, much worse. So the communities that we saw
How does it get worse?
Because the communities that burned last fall didn't have the opportunity to begin recovering right away. And the speed of the recovery process is very important. So, I mean, there were a lot, it was tragic what happened to Paradise, but what Charles said about the support, he's right about that. I mean, we were able to utilize Chico State in the community engagement process. Chico State provided so many resources in terms of faculty, students, facilitators. So did FEMA, the state of California. Charles and residents worked with us to facilitate. And folks, they were scattered around the country, but we were able to have community meetings in a church that survived in Paradise of over 1,000 residents,
right,
and be able to break into small groups and talk one-on-one, or maybe we try to keep the groups as a dozen or less, and then report out. The communities that were affected last year couldn't do that. So they're just beginning their recovery process now. I know because we've been in discussion, as I know Charles has too, just trying to help them figure out what's the best path to take. So they weren't able to meet in person. And if you can't start right away your recovery, and Paradise was on it right away, it could have been worse timing-wise if it had been 2019 versus 2018, in our opinion.
Well, there's also, in my opinion, you know, you have tragedies like Katrina, Hurricane Katrina, or something that's big national news, and it's in a large metropolitan area. The sticking power of that news, to me, seems a little bit longer lasting than a town of 20,000 people in Northern California. So I'm just wondering, I don't even know if there's a question there. I just wrote this down as we were talking, but how are you keeping this momentum going? And maybe it's the Rebuilding Paradise Foundation, or how are you keeping momentum going around this project?
I appreciate that you noticed that, Aaron. One of the things that many organizations throughout the community, and we have a long-term recovery group here that is typically stands up after a federally declared disaster. It follows a FEMA model, and that group has evolved into what's now called the Campfire Collaborative. But basically, it's a group of faith-based organizations, nonprofits, jurisdictions, private sector, all come together. They form committees working on the long-term recovery of the community. And one of the things that all of these organizations, what are called member organizations, recognize is that the ability to continue to bring in focus, not just attention and disaster tourism and that focus, but actual focus on the area, technical capabilities, and bringing and reminding people outside of our region that this is still in need. And so when there's opportunities to talk with different publications and different news organizations, when they come to check in on Paradise, we want to make sure that we talk about the recovery, where we're at, the passion of the community. And one of the things that we as a foundation have taken on is storytelling of and championing the rebuild and the people who are committed to rebuilding. Starting on probably 1 month after the fire, we started interviewing people. Why do you want to go back? Why are you committing to rebuilding? And hearing the stories, not so much the tragedy, but what is it that makes this a truly unique place? Twice a week, we feature a photo on Instagram of a new house that's being built or is recently completed. We have videos that show unique parts of the community that people from around the country, we get messages that say, I really miss that. I miss Gold Nugget Days. I miss Party in the Park. Thank you for sharing this. We've had people tell us that part of the reason why they came back is because they saw a picture of a home being rebuilt on their street and because they were following us. One of the things that's important that we share with other communities that are recently disaster impacted is you need to tell the story of the community, all the organizations. It's imperative that you tell it from your lens and you help champion that passion for the community. I mean, that's what it is. It's people. It's not just the houses. It's the people that make up the community. And so if you can share a little bit of that, it goes a long way. And so I'm an opportunist. I will never turn down an opportunity to talk to somebody on an airplane or at a meeting somewhere if I'm somewhere out of the area. And to once they hear about Paradise and they ask, I paint a realistic picture of where we're at and where some of our needs still lie. And I think that's really important for any disaster affected area. And I do want to just tag on to something that Barry said about if this had happened in 2019, I've had a chance to spend quite a bit of time in Southern Oregon and also with folks in Santa Cruz. And the fact that they never got to meet in person after a disaster is crazy. I could not imagine what would have happened if we were not allowed to go to that disaster recovery center and see friends and neighbors or go to the church and have these meetings and these community events. It would have completely changed the face of this recovery. And so that's why we see an ongoing need to support other disaster affected communities and just get on constant Zooms and like, what can we do? How can we answer questions? How can we provide any type of insight?
There was another fire that hit Paradise last year. I think it's Barry was referencing. So is this going to be the new normal for the foothills of California? Or how do you go about kind of preventing this sort of thing from happening again in the future? I know it's like, have an electric company that maintains their stuff. That really helps. I'll edit that out. But my point is, like, how do you go about, like, how do you go about making sure this doesn't happen again?
So last summer, unfortunately, in the community of Berry Creek, we had the North Complex fire. It was started by lightning weeks earlier, and a wind event came up and drove that fire right down into the eastern flanks of Oroville. It took out another, I believe, 2,500 structures. And one of the things that is apparent with climate change and with the way that we're going through another drought cycle in Northern California, this is a type of event that when you live in a semi-urban or rural area and in the foothills or in the mountains, the wildland urban interface, as Barry's referred to, it's something that you have to know is a reality. Yes. So a lot of the work has to be around mitigation, community-wide mitigation, proper forestry, fuel breaks, right down to the individual property. How are you going to harden your individual home? That comes at a cost. And Paradise was the affordable place to buy a home in the region, and many people don't have extra income to retrofit and harden their homes. So this is where private-public partnerships, philanthropy, and the role of government, and the fact that mitigation dollars are so much better spent than they are in the form of disaster response. It's usually a 1-7 ratio of a dollar costs $7 for disaster recovery, where it costs a dollar for mitigation. And so if we can leverage private and public relationships to be able to help people harden their homes and harden the community with best practices, that's one way to start looking at living in this environment and being prepared in the future. This is going to happen again. It's going to happen to another community. So what can they do, and what are the steps that are being developed around the Western United States to prepare communities that way?
I think Charles, I know he was hiking the morning that the fire started. The list that he just went through is dead on. I mean, it really starts with forest management, but the resources for forest management are inadequate for the scale of the challenge in the Western United States. I mean, I was in Arizona last week. The wildfires there are, I mean, there were a number of fires burning out of control. That was all that was on the news while I was there. When you layer on top of it, though, climate change, and that clearly is affecting Pacific Northwest, maybe the most quickly in terms of wildfires, although maybe that's not fair. It's even broad than that. But drawing out the fuels intensifies these fires. So we don't have, we mismanaged the forest, and now catching up is incredibly important. But then climate change is kind of intensifying things. And then we don't have what we should have, which is fire-resistant construction. Most of the homes that are built in the interface, and climate change, to be honest, is moving the wildland urban interface line. It's not a fixed line. It's not like Charles lives in the wildland urban interface, or Paradise always was in the wildland urban interface. There was a time when it was an agricultural community with no trees. So building fire-resistant homes, which is how Paradise is being built back, is important. But if you don't have that, there's something on the order of 40 million houses that really need to be retrofitted. And then you have maintaining defensible space around your home. That's all critical. And Paradise did not have defensible space on the day of the fire. And it largely did not have fire-resistant construction. And even, honestly, where we did have it in places like Paradise Village, which was a new affordable community that had been built, that development was lost too on the day of the fire, because what your neighbor does affects your home too. And those things together, they just, it's a compounding effect, but there's not an easy solution. And it's tragic that it happened to Paradise, but the truth is there are really hundreds of communities that could be affected by the exact same thing. Paradise is not unique in that way. They just, it was just the worst conditions at the perfect time on the day of the fire, to be honest about it.
Well, Charles, I'm glad you brought up Santa Cruz, because my wife is from Santa Cruz. That's a densely urban area of California. Of San Jose, that's what, 15 miles from there. Santa Cruz is 60,000 or so. It's a smaller town, and it's right next to the ocean. But I was particularly surprised that if it can happen in a dense metropolitan area like the Bay Area, it really can happen anywhere, I guess.
Without a doubt. And when you look at Coffee Park, so 2017, yes, the North Bay fires, the Tubbs fire, and how Coffee Park is just like Chico, where it's sitting across the freeway from the hills. Right. And it was an ember-driven fire that got into a suburban neighborhood, very dense construction, close to each other homes that weren't to WUI standards because they weren't in the WUI. One house starts and you've got wind and heat, and now you've got an urban conflagration that is now consuming 1,400 or 1,500 homes in a couple of hours because there's wind and heat. And that all started because of embers that came from across the freeway in the hills. And so communities, larger communities that are right next to the hills and to the mountains, that needs to be in the thought process as well, is how are we designing the homes that are on the fringes and on the borders? And Chico's built right up against the Green Line and right up to the hills now. And those homes that are built up there don't have to comply with WUI unless you get way back into some of the canyons. So those are the type of thoughts that communities are going to have to wrestle with over time. And one of the things that's going to drive change, insurance availability. And that's been a big struggle for WUI communities across the Western U.S. is insurability.
One thing I think as architects we would say we didn't appreciate until we really got involved in Paradise is the way that a fire behaves. And it's a firestorm is more like a snowstorm in the way that it blows and drifts embers. Mm-hmm. And they literally drift up against structures. They sit in the gutters. Fires burn up underneath the eaves of a home, even if it's sprinklered. So you can have a home that's sprinklered burn from the outside in. And you really have to realize as an architect or anybody who's working on home design or construction that fire is going to exploit any weakness. It doesn't care. All it needs is a crack to get in. And that is it's not just not the way we typically think as designers. You really have to design a shell that's fire retardant and then look for places where drifting can happen and eliminate them. And the homes that are being built in Paradise now are much safer than what was built there before. But Charles is exactly right. These urbanized areas, and I believe Coffee Park, Charles, is still being built back, not to WUI standards, or was built back. I've toured it and it's largely complete. It's not required to be, and we understand that's a higher standard. Those homes are very close together, which also increases the risk. Paradise right now is being built back more spread apart for the time being,
yes.
Which actually, I mean, it sounds counterintuitive, but being spread out a little bit in a high wildfire area actually has advantages from a survivability standpoint.
Infrastructurally, what are some of the issues? Because I think it was one of the documentaries referenced that it's not so much just the house is gone, but there's contamination that happens in the soil and everything. So when you're designing structures for people to get back into this area, what are some of the challenges that they're facing?
Well, the first thing we have to do is ensure the site has been cleared properly. So I understand there has been organizations that have come up there, cleared up the sites. In fact, when I started going back up there again, I started seeing lots that were pretty level lots. And when they were cleared, there was just, you know, a 15-foot hole in the lot. And so they would take out a large portion of the topsoil along with it, whatever degree was at the foundation, and more to remove all that contamination. And then so the other challenge was sort of the seepage into the water. And so that was sort of a big issue where I understand residents are collecting water and storing water now because there was at some point, and maybe Charles could speak to this, that there was some problems with the water, public water system there. And it was contaminated. And that being said, I think in the long-term recovery plan, you know, coming up with a sewer system instead of a septic system is in the works. And I think City of Chico is figuring out how they're going to connect with, you know, because it's coming down the hill towards this way and going down towards Oroville, I think. So there are some of those things. Beyond that, it was also the landscapes, right? So there are, for example, this year, I've noticed trees that made it last year that are not going to be making it this year. And these are some of the trees that survived. And so there's some of that. So one of the lots we just, we're working on a project right now. There was lots of trees that we thought would make it, but we had to remove them. We had an arborist come in and take a look at them. They were just going to be too dangerous to have and then eventually fall on the structure and whatnot. So those are some of the challenges that people are going through. But more or less, it's really the initial cleanup period when they came in, they removed all the debris, pulled it all out, and removed a large portion of the topsoil along with it. And so whatever we're doing, we're bringing in soil to raise back up to level and graded accordingly for the new structure tenant.
The infrastructure has been is probably one of the key portions of the community recovery plan that UDA put together, and they identified it early on. The entire town of Paradise is the largest community west of the Mississippi that is on septic. Commercial and residential. So in order for us to build back and be able to attract businesses and residents, economic development, and the ability to do this, we need a centralized wastewater system that serves the main cores of town. To be able to build affordable workforce housing at densities that we can afford to live in, we are going to need that type of wastewater solution. It's not going to go for the whole town. Topographically, it just doesn't make sense, but it's going to go through main corridors. The other thing that Ruben highlighted was water for a long time was a challenge. Our water system is gravity fed. It depressurized on the day of the fire and pulled a lot of contaminants back in. But the great news is that the majority of the system's delivering clean water now. And so there's just isolated pockets where they're going to have to replace water lines and water mains. But for now, when you build a home, if your street has clear water, they replace the lateral from the main to your home. So you can, you get a certificate. And right now, the town of Paradise's water exceeds state level requirements for water clarity and levels of contaminants that many communities may not even meet. And so we have very good water. And that's really something that has been a big win for the community. And then the last piece of infrastructure that's really critical is that PG&E, who was found at fault for starting the fire, they've committed to undergrounding all of the electric utilities throughout the entire community. One of the big challenges during the fire is not only trees falling in the road, but power poles, burning power poles, and now that's blocked people's exit. And so the community is adamant that those lines go underground. So now we just need to get the telecoms to join suit so there's no poles left in the community. So as other communities look to build, that's a smart way to go, is just make sure you're underground because it eliminates a whole nother threat.
Just related infrastructure, as Ruben said, the standing burn trees, unfortunately, they've become a hurdle to building back because if you have standing burn trees on the neighbor's property that could fall on your property, that's not something that necessarily you can take care of. And as we learned through the process, this isn't something the government's excited about dealing with at the federal or state level. I think it was unprecedented the number of standing burn trees that we had in an urbanized area. So addressing that with the infrastructure too was one of the other major community-wide challenges before you can get to the individual property. So when you build back, there's two parts of things. There's the public side, the public realm, where you have to deal with the infrastructure from the streets to the utilities and deal with the standing burn trees and the right-of-ways. And then we have private property. Then you get to the private property. So you have your property. You have to get cleaned and ready to build back. Then you got your neighbor's property, which may impact your property because the trees in Paradise, if you've been there, they were very tall. And they definitely could fall across an entire neighbor's property if they came down. So some of these macro issues really had to be dealt with before a robust rebuilding effort could take place.
We've talked for now 45 minutes about, you know, everything that's happened, everything that's led up to it. But I really want to know, you know, I don't want to be all doom and gloom for an hour, but you guys are doing really great work. Can we talk about the forming of Rebuilding Paradise Foundation? Where does Paradise stand now? And what does Paradise look like in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, and on down the road?
The Rebuild Paradise Foundation was born out of just an absolute commitment and desire to see our community come back. It was waking up the morning, not even waking up, just walking out to the car the day after the fire. I didn't sleep that night, but looking in the back of the car and seeing the bag of clothes I threw together for my wife and I, and the bag of clothes that my kids threw together with their favorite toy. And then there was a bag of soccer coaching stuff that I forgot to take out from the week before when the season had ended. And I looked at that and I honestly laughed for a second and said, well, at least I could coach a soccer team. You know, like that could happen. And soccer has kind of, you know, we're not a huge soccer family. We play in the fall. It's something for the kids to do, but this has kind of become a rallying point for me. And why we started the foundation is that I was determined to see kids playing soccer on a Saturday morning at the intermediate school again, and for my kids to be able to go and get a donut if they scored a goal. Like that, to me, means that the community's coming back. And this fall, we are starting soccer in Paradise again. It is what I have gone back to time and time again And it's what brought people, as we were lucky enough, we had a friend who lined up a small rental home in downtown Chico for us. So we were one of the lucky people that had safe and stable housing a couple of days after the fire. We didn't even know this was happening. I couldn't even get to that thought yet. And he said, hey, I've got a place on hold for you. Do you want it? And I said, yes, I don't care what it is. We'll take it. Doesn't matter. So we're there, and now we're having friends come and sleep on our floor and on our couch because they have nowhere to go. They're sleeping in their cars. They don't want to be at a shelter. And talking to people who are in total desperation. And when you mention that, hey, we're going to rebuild and we're going to see soccer again on a Saturday morning, you see people go from their heads hung down crying to sitting up a little bit. You're really going to rebuild? You think the town's coming back? That little bit of just being able to provide that confidence and mentioning that to a friend and somebody that's close to you to see their optimism change even slightly meant we have to do something more. And that's what led to the idea of, okay, how can we start a foundation and I'm really like a long-term thinker. And I wanted to look at how can we capture some of the goodwill and the philanthropy that's coming into our area and leverage that for the long-term. How can we build relationships with Chico State and the architecture program and sit down with an expert like Barry and say, what can we do to build and design resources that leverage technology that provide grants that will actually go to help people rebuild their homes? And how can we discover technologies that will lower incremental costs around the area? And that's how we've looked at this and how we've developed all of our programs towards that end goal of let's design something that in 5 years is still useful. Grants are eventually going to expire. Philanthropy is going to be harder and harder to access, and it continues to be that way just because there's other disasters. There was COVID, there's other fires, there's hurricanes. But can we develop technology tools that people can access? The floor plan library that Ruben's been instrumental with us on, people can access low-cost master plans. It will save them tens of thousands of dollars in the process and make it faster for them to access a home for the people that just want to build a home. They never plan on designing or building a custom home in their life. And that's the way, and we have this kind of lens that we evaluate things through, and it's, does it attract, incentivize, and retain residents and businesses to this area? So that's how we evaluate projects that we take on and things that we choose to do going forward. And every day since the fire woken up and just, it's this gnawing feeling of what else can we do? What do you need? How can we help? And we can't do immediate needs. There's plenty of organizations out there that can do that. So we're looking at bigger picture items like that. And Barry's team has built an incredible roadmap and a book that our jurisdiction and our community can look to. Even as our community grows and changes in the recovery, we still have a document that was created that we can go back to and say, what were our intentions? What are some of the identified needs? It's going to look a little different now than it did 3 years ago, but that is a roadmap that allows our community to walk forward.
And Barry, I'm going to get to you in a second, but Ruben, as an architect in Chico, what is your firm doing? And as well as a professor at, you know, CSU Chico, what are you doing in the rebuilding efforts to help get people back in homes? Because I'd imagine it's a fine line. I have to say that it's a fine line of you're running a business. And so you have a service that you're providing, but you know that this is generally like a human right. And it's no fault of anyone else's.
You know, going back to our early conversation, we're talking about architecture with a big A, right? And part of me left the profession, not full time, but left the profession because I was a little bit disillusioned in like, is this what I really went to school for? And I remember when I was in grad school, I did a lot of community-based projects. This was right after the LA riots and down in at SciArc at the time. And so I was questioning myself about my own career. What am I doing? Am I doing this? This is what I want to do. So teaching was something I thought I'd get into to discover that question. And so when I started teaching, part of my teaching beyond the classroom is working with various community organizations, something that I got inspired by professors of mine when I was attending grad school. And so I don't really run a full-time practice where I have a lot of projects. I'm more of a consultant. I connect with other architecture firms and engineers locally to work with them on a design capacity. And so I've always been interested in community work. And when I realized that, you know, this is a perfect opportunity for one to reexamine what architecture can be in the classroom, because we all get these glamorous ideas of what architects do. And, you know, you see these beautiful magazines and pictures and people get this idea that this is what we do, which we really don't at the end of the day. And I also realized that as a practitioner, I was serving really you know, the years before this, I was really serving a very particular demographic, a demographic that had financial capabilities to do what they wanted to do in terms of building. So here, it was a different approach because, one, you have a community which is very different, has a different culture and understanding of how they want to live, different rituals of day-to-day activities. At the same time, you have a community that needs to be rebuilt, and there is no, you know, monetary financial structure there to rebuild off of. And so this created a very different challenge in terms of what an architect or a designer should go about doing. And I proposed that in the classroom, which eventually became an internship program for the last 2 years that we've been working with Rebuild Paradise. And meanwhile, I just extend myself in any capacity. I've met with many individual clients who want to build homes. I've talked them out of building homes because of their conditions of their lots or their financial capabilities. At the same time, I'm helping a few homeowners also rebuild their homes after the fire in a more personal level, like traditional architectural practice. But I think, you know, one of the things that I like, well, I feel that I really can help in the community is I'm a resource. I've worked all over the world. I'm not really running a practice where I'm competing for work. I'm an academic. And so I'm here to be a resource. And just like Barry, it's, you know, UDA has created this urban plan vision for Paradise. What I'm trying to do with Charles is to create a small part of that vision, which is really the actual home. And what does the home need to be if you want to rebuild by the before, after a fire? What should you look out for? How should you build it? What should you use to build it? It's sort of like a book about rebuilding after the fire, and not necessarily rebuilding something glamorous and big and with a big A, architecture with a big A, but rather something that is affordable, works, well-planned, livable, and in turn, aids to the building of a bigger picture, which is the community. So that's how I'm kind of involved in my capacity.
And Barry, it's a similar sort of scenario, but I think it would be really easy. You know, UDA comes in, here's your master plan. Thanks for the fee. Good luck. We'll see you later. What is the continued involvement? And in your opinion, what does Paradise look like in 5, 10, 15 years?
Well, one thing I would say, which we didn't say earlier, is, we were working in the region before. We're still working in the region. We're back working in the region. I'll be there again in 3 weeks. And I've been back this spring. But the fire acted like, it acted more like an earthquake for the Tri-County area. And it forever changed the landscape of the Tri-County area. And what I mean is every large and small jurisdiction was impacted. It completely recast settlement patterns, and they're never going to go back to exactly the way they were. That's going to affect the new Paradise is crafted. So probably a third of it will be those dedicated residents like Charles that said, I'm going back. And, you know, when Charles told us his story, I mean, I took notes, but I could still draw the path that he took that day, just from the way he told me the story about what he did in the morning, how he went back to his house and collected his kids, and the route he took to leave town. That's how much of an impression it left on me. But I could have told you that day that Charles was going back. I mean, there wasn't a question. And we met a number of residents that are that committed. So there's, when you talk about folks that live in the wild and urban interface, it's, you have to remember these are communities and neighborhoods that they're committed to. So folks they're going to rebuild and go back. And that's going to be about a third of the community. There's another group that's on the fence and has to decide long-term and may come back. And some folks have left. But regionally, it's very difficult to build in this area. It's an agricultural area. There are green belts. There are limitations. There's very few infill sites left in any of the jurisdictions. So we're right back to where we started. The Paradise isn't just a wonderful community, but it's a place that actually has to be rebuilt over time when you look out long term. And I think for us, that's one of the fascinating things. It's about, you know, just looking at the problem solving of, let's be realistic here. And we know that forest management's an issue. We know that climate change, we can step on the gas pedal, but we're going to have a very hard time reversing it. We are working harder on fire-resistant buildings, and maintaining defensible space is critical. But we need to continue as a society really to work on solving the larger problem, because these fires are going to happen. They are earthquakes, and they are going to have regional impacts. And that isn't going to change. And we're going to be there to help them begin to work in support and with what we can bring to the table. And then, as you know, you've heard on this podcast, there's so many other resources that have to come to the table to continue the implementation. But the residents, at the end of the day, the reason you need to listen to them is they're the ones that have to carry the mantle forward to rebuild their community. It's Charles and his neighbors at the end of the day that are going to determine the future of Paradise. It's that generation. And it doesn't matter where we've worked on. And I really wish rebuilding communities in a way wasn't part of our practice, because it says that we have a problem. It didn't used to be. This is a relatively, you know, new thing as disasters have become more severe. But those residents are the ones that are going to carry the mantle forward. And we all need to work together to figure out the bigger problem. Places that burned last year were not necessarily in the wild and urban interface either. The places in Southern Oregon, an arson fire burned through three communities. None of that area was in the wild and urban interface. We have a real problem because our communities are not built. Paradise, the exception now, to withstand wildfires. They just aren't.
And I think it would require changes in, you know, code, zoning,
absolutely,
those kind of things. So it's absolutely not just a design problem. It's a larger problem.
Absolutely. The code, the building codes have to become more stringent, because you look at what's outside of homes. We talk about the homes. Well, what about the propane tank on the grill, the car that was parked outside the shed, the wood fence that runs up to it? Well, it sounds trivial until a fire happens. And then those things become the match. So, but as we study Paradise and its recovery, it is unique. It was the worst wildfire in California's history in terms of destruction and loss of life. And there's lessons to be learned. And folks like Charles and Ruben that can continue to tell that story and live there through the rebuilding, it's really important that we all listen and not be arrogant as architects. We have a lot of work to do and we can help, but don't
assume
that we can do it all. Yeah, you need to, as Ruben said, you need to learn and you need to not assume you can do it all. But together, I think we can do a much better job than we currently are.
And Charles, this question is for you. Just, you know, the Rebuild Paradise Foundation, I'm sure what you don't need is some big architect trying to sell high-end homes in your community. What and how can people help support the rebuilding effort?
The rebuild effort can be supported in a number of ways. Technical capacity for a lot of different organizations and jurisdictions is always welcomed at the appropriate time. So if you have a particular technical capacity that can benefit in recovery, feel free to reach out to jurisdictions and organizations and see what their needs may be. Technical capacity, especially pro bono technical capacity for understaffed or underfunded jurisdictions and organizations is definitely helpful. The thing that our community and others are really struggling with is balancing mitigation, codes, requirements for home hardening, and affordability, and with material prices where they are. So people who understand that they need to strike a balance, you can't build just an expensive concrete bunker that has the most high-end windows that are you know, triple pane and metal cased so they don't fall out if they get hot. You know, that isn't realistic for a working class community. So any proven or not proven, but innovative home solutions that don't go above market rate house cost per square foot, because it's just not possible for the majority of our population to afford some of the models and some of the ideas that have been brought forth to our community. But continuing to invest in the technology like 3D printed homes, like ICF, like AAC concrete, and some of these things that are just starting to take hold, but our workforce here hasn't yet caught up to be able to bring that to a scale that can support mass building, but continuing to innovate in cost reducing technology that also increases the survivability of homes is huge. And then the other part is that there are a number of community organizations that are doing incredible work and providing direct assistance to people as they look to recover. And I would encourage people to explore those. If what we do does not align with somebody, if they're looking to give to our community, we'd be happy to work with them to identify other community organizations that could benefit from that type of philanthropy. If there's people out there who want to be a part of this recovery. The other side of that is a lot of corporations are starting to look at employee engagement and bringing out employee volunteers to the area to participate in volunteer rebuilds for our most underprivileged community members to get them back into homes. So that's another way people can serve, is they can come out and they can volunteer build.
And what's the website for Rebuilding Paradise?
So Rebuild Paradise Foundation is www.rebuildparadise.org. And we'd be happy to point people in the direction of whatever way they'd look to participate.
Well, Ruben, Charles, Barry, this has been, I'm sorry we have to have this conversation, but I think in terms of an architectural sense, this has been very informative. So I appreciate all of you taking the time and, you know, Charles sharing your story and everything. So thanks a lot and enjoy, everybody.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to an episode of Designed, a podcast by Architectural Record. If you enjoyed this episode, we would appreciate you taking a moment to subscribe to the podcast, give us a rating, and leave us a comment. Have a wonderful day.